And so, as the beautiful strains of the Restless History theme music fades away, we welcome you to our December live show. Dominic, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Tom. I've just been looking through the comments to see. So we did this a little slightly different time, but it's great to see so many people. Karen from Berkeley, California, Holly from Massachusetts, Lauren from Oaxaca, Brian from Leighton Buzzard, and the Lone Destroyer from Annapolis, Maryland.
Anyone from Costa Rica? He said nervously.
Yes. There's people from Charleston, from Minneapolis, from Finsbury Park, from West Berkshire, from Cambridge, from Canterbury, from Sheffield, from Seattle, from Silicon Valley.
All the world.
From Atlanta, yeah, from Dublin, from some of the debatable lands. Now, you might have seen me hosting, waving this mug. That's because one of our listeners runs a podcast, Tom. I don't know, are you interested in tax law?
No, I could not be less interested in tax law.
Well,
I hate everything to do with tax.
Would you enjoy having somebody interested in tax who's based in Gibraltar looking after your finances? Because if
actually,
you play your cards right,
I've suddenly developed a massive interest.
If you play your cards right, this is an excellent podcast. I came on as a guest, and they sent me a mug to that.
Are you transferring your tax affairs to Gibraltar?
Sadly, no. There was no mention of that.
That's the reason
I did their podcast, because I thought. But they've asked me to promote this mug, so this is a lovely International Tax Bites mug. It's the name of the podcast, and I'm hoping that having done this, there will now be talk of moving my tax affairs offshore.
That prompts me to ask why are there no Restless History mugs? I mean, who wouldn't like a Restless History mug?
We first talked about merchandise 18 months ago.
Yeah, we were going to have a wrong pair of shoes brand, weren't we?
We were going to have all
you
that.
Could, you could wear the wrong kind
of
shoes,
Tom?
For every occasion.
I hope I'm not giving up anything away when I say it's been as forthcoming as our contract.
See you have been hanging out with tax lawyers.
Which has similarly never actually seen the light of day.
Well, I don't know what the tax lawyers would make of that.
No. So, here we go. Is there somebody from Costa Rica? That's the question. We will perhaps come to Costa Rica a bit later, won't we? Because we are obviously deep into
the World Cup.
Into the World Cup of history, the World Cup indeed of football. Tom, we were just commenting on the abysmal. So if you don't want to know the results, close your ears.
Look away.
Of Japan, Croatia, but we were just commenting, is now closed, I hope, on the abysmal quality of the Japanese penalties.
I've done nothing but sport for the past 3 days, basically, because we had the Authors Cricket Club Awards on Saturday evening, which was hosted chez moi. So we had to prepare the house all day. And then obviously lots of lads, total carnage.
Right.
And so then we had to clean it up all Sunday.
Oh, that's nice.
With time off only to watch France and England, which
was
great.
Is that the sporting stuff? Is that the explanation of why you refused to go and pick up your daughter from university?
Yes, it is.
And you made her take the bus all the way home?
Yes.
I think it's important that listeners know just how kind you are.
Well, it's all about, it's got to teach her, you know.
Yeah, teaching resilience, like the Duke of Edinburgh Award. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, that's what it is.
Yes, exactly so. So we go with the gold star because she got back in one piece. So that was exciting. Then today, England won the test match as well, which you hadn't even realised was going on in heroic circumstances. So I know that will mean nothing to people, but that's what I've done. And before that, Dominic, I was in the north. So I was in, I went to Lindisfarne.
Lovely.
Went to see the Lindisfarne Gospels in Newcastle. Went to Edinburgh. Had a fabulous time. So anyway, that's boring. I know that hearing details of people's holidays is incredibly dull, so I won't go on about it.
Okay.
Shall we look at some... Oh, the Spotify Wrapped stuff. Yes. So to everyone who's messaged us about the enormous amount of time they've spent listening to The Rest Is History as measured by Spotify, we thank you from the very depths of our hearts, do we not?
We do. Tom, I'm sorry, I'm so distracted because Fable Skull says, have you got a cold, Tom? You sound sexier than normal. He doesn't sound like me, Fable Skull. I'll tell you that for nothing.
I have got a cold. Yes, I have.
Oh.
And I'm glad that you're finding it sexy. Nobody in my house is finding it remotely sexy, I have to say.
So, yes, we had one lovely message from Endress Marks, who said, he has spent 17,273 minutes listening to your podcast. When I confronted my brother, who recommended your podcast to me in the spring about this, he replied that he himself would listen to your podcast for 25,839 minutes, which means collectively we spent almost 30 days listening to the rest is history. But the champion is somebody on Twitter called Joost Nederpelt, who works out that he has spent 48,127 minutes listening to the rest is history, which is 33 days. I'm thinking, Tom, that he's fallen asleep with it and left it running. I don't believe that anybody could.
That is a phenomenal amount of time. But I think, I mean, absolute kudos to the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, it's very, the Marx Brothers, very good. They are the Marx Brothers. I mean, they're literally the Marx Brothers. Theo points out that Callum probably beats those stats. Callum, because Callum, I think, is not, he's producing the live stream, isn't he? And I think he's not merely a producer. I think he's also a keen listener, Tom, which is not always the case, I think, with our producers.
That's wonderful to know, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very nice. Yeah. It's made with love. Right. Let's move on to some history. Do you want to, should we talk about
Yes. So we have a note from Rob E. Anyone spot this from Matthew Said in the Times yesterday? Matthew Said is a former table tennis champion, isn't he?
He has turned
Olympic table. Yeah.
Tom, do you know what? I was at university with Matthew Said.
And he in is he a Balliol
same
man?
College. Yeah, he was. And I have to say, in those days, everybody found his table tennis a bit risible.
Why? Just the very fact he was playing it? Or
yeah, he played a lot of tables.
Good at it. He wasn't very good at it, or what?
People would sort of say, oh, he's a very serious ping pong player. And then everyone would start laughing. But then he's obviously made a career off the back of that, hasn't he? Because he writes,
can he do magical things with ping pong balls? I don't know how much talent he's have to...
I don't want to give anything away. He may well be listening. I don't think he was a man who would be given to japery with ping pong balls. Okay. He was quite a serious man, as you might guess from his columns.
Well, I guess serious business. Okay, but anyway, he wrote in the Times yesterday, one of the blind spots in historical analysis concerns psychology. We chronicle queens and kings, wars and famines, but not the subtle trends in the way people perceive and think about the world. So what do you make of that?
I just think it's utter tosh and rubbish. A man who's never read a history book. We chronicle kings and queens, wars and famines. I mean, what century is he in? The 17th? I just think he says we don't chronicle the way people think about the world. I mean, that's just absolute nonsense. I mean, there's even in British high street bookseller like Waterstones, you can find books that are about how people perceived the world. I mean, think about the people we've had on the podcast. I mean, Andrea Wolf talking about the romantic, you know, Germany, the Jena set. That was all about the perception of the world.
Isn't there also further complication that the very idea of psychology is quite a recent one?
It is. Yeah, so it is. That's true.
If you start, I mean, it was kind of when Freud was having his heyday, there was a massive trend for kind of identifying Oedipal complexes in historical figures. So Nero, there was a lot of Freudian analysis of Nero, who of course murdered his mother.
Yeah.
Got it the wrong way round.
Yeah.
An underplayed recognition is how differently people have the very processes of mental. The thing I always remember is how different dreams were to the ancients. They record dreams and they seem to bear no resemblance whatsoever to the kind of dreams that we would have. And I don't know whether that's because they did dream in a different way or because they understood dreams in a different way or because the conventions that governed how you record dreams were different, but there's a really, really striking contrast there.
That's interesting. But I mean, Tom, it's not just dreams, right? I mean, the way people think about all the oceans of ink that have been spilled on the transition from paganism to Christianity. I mean, something that would obviously appeal to you, or the way that, to say the subtle trends, the way people perceive and think about the world, I think about the historians who've written about the Reformation, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment. I mean, these are colossal changes Well, it didn't take us 10,000 hours, Alistair, did it? I mean, whether or not we were even there that's doubtful. I wouldn't describe.
All right. I think you've dissed your old college chum enough. Right. So that's him dealt with. The next thing, looking forward to hearing you harumph about this, the Benin bronzes. So the Horniman Museum in Southeast London, notable for having an enormously well-proportioned walrus. which they got and overstuffed. So great favourite with my children when they were young.
Yeah.
And the Horniman Museum is signing over its collection of 72 objects looted from the Kingdom of Benin. It is the first action of its kind from a UK museum. And Simon Girdleston comments that this seems a more sensible approach to these sort of issues. Is this the kind of situation? Is this how this kind of situation should be handled? And should artifacts be returned like this? Whereas Armand Emmanuel Duc de Richelieu comments, I don't think the solution is to return everything looted because that would basically empty the British Museum. But in certain circumstances, it just does not make any sense to keep them. And more often than not, the excuses for keeping them in the BM are rich and condescending. So okay. What's your take on that?
The Duc de Richelieu was an excellent form at the beginning of that sentence and then threw it away at the end there. Jesus. Do people really want to hear this? See the Daily Mailometer kind of gear up? And
well, so are you properly Daily Mail on this? On the Benin Bronzes specifically?
No, because the Daily Mail would probably tone down my real opinions. I'm absolutely uncompromising on this. I don't think... first of all, you're not giving them back. You're giving them away. Because you're not giving them back to the people who made them. You're giving them to different people who happen to live in the same place and maybe are descended from the original people. But I don't know that that necessarily gives, unless you're a nationalist, which clearly lots of people are, nationalists believe that the things have this sort of mystical connection to the descendants of those who made them. And they should be, remain in their original place. I don't. I just think, I don't actually, Tom, I'm worried that people will leave the club if I say,
well, I can see people vanishing in droves.
Yeah. Stephen Clark, it's loot. So what, Stephen? I don't care. I don't care. I genuinely don't care. I mean, don't leave the club. Tom is a nice guy. You know, you don't judge it. Don't
Shall I provide more subtlety and nuance?
Well, I mean, it's not an unnuanced view. I mean, if you don't care,
it's quite an unnuanced view. But I mean, because I would say that there are certain objects that do have a kind of emotional, spiritual, whatever, cultural resonance for people. And I think that if there are objects that have a kind of matter emotionally to people, and that there is, say, a state to whom that, say, the Benin Bronzes are of significance, then I think they should be returned. Now, I don't know enough about Benin to comment on that. So Stonehenge is not loot, unless you think that it was stolen by Ireland, from Ireland, by giants, which maybe it was. But I think that the issue with the Benin Bronzes is firstly that they were nicked from a kingdom that that line of descent is still in situ, I gather. So there is still a king of Benin.
Yeah.
And what I don't know is the degree to which the functioning of the Kingdom of Benin would be, you know, what kind of degree of emotional investment do they have in these bronzes? So imagining that somebody had come to Westminster Abbey in the late 19th century and had sacked London and had gone off with the crown jewels and with all the apparatus necessary for coronations or something like that, I would be all in favour of bringing it back because I think it would matter to us. And likewise, I suspect that the Benin Bronzes have a similar significance for the kings of Benin, I would guess.
You would want them back for nationalistic reasons. That's how it is. Let's be honest.
Yeah, I'm happy with that.
I'm happy with that. If they were in Paris, if the crown jewels
were in
Paris,
I would say bring back
but I wouldn't be saying that out of principle. I'd be saying that out of pure nationalistic fervour.
Contrast, say, would be with the Parthenon friezes, where there is no democratic state of Athens. The democracy has gone. Mm-hmm. And the Parthenon friezes really had no emotional resonance for Greeks until middle of the 19th century, really. Or the Rosetta Stone.
So,
I mean, the Rosetta Stone meant nothing.
So you don't believe in giving away the Parthenon friezes?
On balance, I don't really care either way.
Right.
I think there is a case for them being in both. You know, you can make the case for them being in Athens. I think that it would make the museum in Athens incredible. It would be an amazing opportunity to go and see them all together. Equally, I can see that there's a case for keeping them in London, but I don't think there's a moral case in the case of the Parthenon friezes.
Yeah.
But I do think that there might be a case. I simply don't know enough about the Benin bronzes to comment on it. But I think that there is a kingdom of Benin, even though it's kind of been absorbed into the fabric of modern day Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think that it's a functioning political cultural entity. And therefore, I think it should have it back.
not back. You're giving it away. You're giving it to different people. Sarah Carey in the comment says, "Who would you give it back to?" You're not giving it back. You're giving it to descendants.
Well, maybe you see, I wouldn't. Would I give it back to the kingdom to the state of Nigeria? No, but I'd give it back to the kingdom of Benin.
Now, Michael Jacoby, I'm looking at the comments because I'm not claiming any great principle on this. I'm just telling you my gut reaction, but I'm interested in what other people have to say. Michael Jacoby makes a very reasonable point. What about Nazi looting of Jewish paintings possessions? Should they be returned? You see, this, I suppose, Michael, would be the obvious flaw in my argument. It's not that I'm unaware of the flaw. In this case, obviously, my immediate sympathy would be with the original owners. And I would say, yes, I think you would expect, you would back restitution there, wouldn't you, Tom? I mean, it'd be very hard to make that case.
Yes, I would.
Well, they've got it, so yeah, they can keep it. So I'm not claiming at all that my argument is grounded in some carefully thought out principle at all. But do you know what? I hate that thing that just because you've got your kind of PhD, with it, you get a kind of piece of paper that says you're no longer allowed to express the opinions of a man in the pub. Yeah, the end of Dominic's pod washing endeavor. Yeah, the pod washing was always a bit skin deep there, wasn't it? I mean,
It's all gone. It's all gone tits up there.
Well, it's because Tom keeps bringing up the Pippin Daily Mail, and so any attempt to escape my not that I would want to escape it. In case you're listening,
well, I know what you're trying to do, and so I'm trying to.
Yeah, to derail it.
I think
this is a massively interesting topic. I think
which we should come back to.
We should probably do a podcast about this at some point. You know, should
we need to educate ourselves, don't we?
No, I don't.
Ben and bronzes. Do you know about the Ben and bronzes? I don't know anything about.
I know all that. Yes, fine, Tom. I mean, I know you want to do it in a worthy way. Right. Let's. There's always. I mean, as we often say, certainly the bonus podcast. There's always the shadow of the golf club, isn't there? Whenever we get off the facts and we get onto...
we start ranting about things we don't really
know. So talking of the shadow of the golf club, Tom, this would interest you. A big story in Britain in the last few weeks, or certainly the last week or so, and I don't know how many of our international listeners will be interested in this or not, but maybe they'll have residences in their own country. The results of the latest census over 10 years in Britain have been published. And for the first time, less than half of the population of England and Wales had described themselves as Christian. And so, as Brown says on the Discord, Tom Holland, and yet. So, Tom, does this matter? I mean, a lot of people, the newspaper coverage is that, this is a seismic moment. This is obviously it's a development of long trends, but is it a big change?
I think it does matter to the degree that the argument that I've been making is that... people who say who would define themselves as atheist or humanist are essentially Christian in their assumptions. Mm-hmm. And I won't go into that because I've talked about it. God knows how often. But when I looked at the statistics, what I found interesting was that the number of humanists and self-defined atheists has gone down as well. So in a sense,
to your ears, you hate humanists.
No, I don't. I I would have defined myself.
They hate you.
They
sorry, I got it wrong.
Me.
They hate you.
Yeah, they do hate me. So I thought that I was surprised by that because I'd assumed that to a degree that the people who cared enough not to define themselves as Christian would that was such an important part of their identity that they would define themselves as atheist or humanist, but they're not doing that. And I think that I think that atheism or kind of Richard Dawkins type evangelical atheism, I've said again and again, I think that is a kind of Christianity that is fading along with Christian identity, which I think proves my point to a degree.
Tim Basby he's exulting. I can look at him in the chat. He's exulting at the atheism.
But so I think that, what is happening is not that people are necessarily hostile to Christianity or to institutional religion or anything like that. It's just that they don't care. They know literally nothing about it. Mm. And I do think that the fading of a basic understanding, say, of biblical stories or what bishops are, or, this kind of pretty basic stuff that for most of the history of Britain, people have been able to take for granted. I do think that is massive, and I don't quite know how it will play out. But I think one way in which it might play out is that people will take and run Christian ideas, and it, they will start to kind of mutate and take on increasingly, from a Christian perspective, kind of slightly strange.
This is your thesis about wokeism, phenomena, isn't it? The wokeism is Christianity, yeah, kind of. So Mary Kirk Alves asks a very good question. What do people say they are then? Now, I think what's happened actually is that people...
No religion, I think they say.
They would say no religion. Now, I think what's happened here, Mary Kirk, is this. I think what's actually happened is that the level of religious observance in Britain has declined gradually certainly over our lifetime. But what has changed is that people who once would have ticked the box that they regarded as the default, which was Church of England. Yeah. Which people didn't tick it because they went to services. They ticked it because they thought, I'm a patriotic, normal person. So C of E is the obvious. I mean, that was the sort of default. Now what's happened is the people who tick that box are the people who actually go. And the default is to say, I don't think about it. I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Don't you think, Tom? True. I mean, I think
I do think that. But I think also that not believing in it is which had always been a strong marker of identity and was a kind of tribute to how significant it remained, that's fading now as well. I think if you are perturbed and angry enough about Christianity to define yourself against it, that's a tribute to the cultural hole that Christianity has.
Yeah.
I think if you simply don't care because it doesn't even intrude on your thoughts, then that's a much, much bigger reflection of its fading.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. All right, we should crack on, shouldn't we? Sorry, everybody. I know there's lots of people who are really interested in this topic, and maybe we'll come back. The secularization of Britain is an interesting subject, Tom, and we could maybe return to it.
Well,
now, of course, the difference between the United States and Europe is a really interesting subject. We touched on that a little bit with Andrew Preston, but we never really dug into it, I think, as much as we should.
We could do an episode on the idea of the secular.
The idea of the secular. I can see you pitching that to the producers, and I can see their faces. Right.
Oh, we call it secularism. That's fine.
The death of God, Tom. You'd call it the death of God. Tom and I have a long running, well, it's only been running about 2 weeks with the World Cup, a disagreement about titles. Yeah, see, I knew the producers would like that. We have a disagreement about titles. Tom wants to call things secularism, and I want to call them the death of God. What was the disagreement we had?
No, you didn't. You don't call it. No, you don't. You want to kind of call it, you know, hot babes. Whoa. It's basically the kind of thing you wanted. Well, you wanted to call the history of America, what was it, 200 years of sex and violence.
Yeah, that's what
there
I
was literally
it.
No,
what did you want to call it?
Episodes.
A special relationship question. That's what you wanted to call it.
Yeah, it was the obvious title. It was a good title.
what's tomorrow's called?
Calvin's cancel culture.
And what was I going to call it?
You wanted to call it
the cancel killing, culture, the killing, killed.
The killing of a
yeah. Or the whole as the goal hanger thing just came up. The massive row about what we were going to call Bart Van Loo's episode, the history's greatest artist debate. What did you want to call that, Tom? Jan Van Eyck.
In Bruges, I think I wanted to call
In Bruges. You want to call it in Bruges, and I said, call it the greatest artist in history.
Ever.
So you don't spend all these years working for a top newspaper, Tom, without learning a thing or two. Right.
Well, I was relieved that Bart didn't pick up on that, because I didn't. The reason I was worried about it was I don't think he had said that Van Eyck was the greatest.
No, he hadn't.
Ever.
He hadn't. But I said it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
I know. I know. But I was worried. I was worried that he might, kick up a fuss about it. But he's too nice.
He didn't. Yeah, he's too nice. Right. Let's talk about some episodes while you start to talk about Senegal. Graham Jackson says, "I'm just going to hold up, Graham." Okay. Right.
Excellent.
Let's talk about Senegal.
Okay. So Stephen Clark. The Senegal episode, which went out yesterday because England were playing Senegal, was I thought the most sensitive episode that we've done, didn't you? Or are you going
sensitive.
To? You're going to, yeah. Treading on, to the degree that we were slightly treading on eggshells. Because it was the first episode that we had done devoted to the issue of the Atlantic slave trade.
Yeah.
Which is obviously a huge
You were
theme.
Nervous about it, Tom. You were nervous. I'm not going to hide that from the audience.
I just thought, this is the first episode that we've done on the Atlantic slave trade. And I'd done it thinking that, you know, it would be a moving tribute to this incredible monument, which had you know, was very much part of my imagination. And then I read up about it and was appalled to discover that it was all basically, it wasn't at all what it seemed to be. Fake. But also thought this is such an interesting topic because as we said in the episode, it kind of touches on all kinds of, you know, the way that objects of pilgrimage develop. Does it matter whether things that inspire pilgrims to go there, whether they actually happen there, all that kind of stuff. Slightly bleeding into the theme of the Kaaba as well, which was another sensitive topic that I was slightly nervous about. But I thought it was a really, really interesting topic. And Stephen Clark, coming off the back of it, has, here are some other historical sites that might well be based on the stretching of what happened. Ford Theatre, Washington, D.C. The original fell into disrepair, although now clearly a place of pilgrimage. The Cavern Club in Liverpool, knocked down, as above. Tintagel Abbey, almost certainly it had nothing to do with Tintagel Castle, I guess that would be. Almost certainly had nothing to do with King Arthur, apart from in people's imaginations, which in itself is historically fascinating. Well, I mean, Tintagel Castle was literally built to be a kind of fantasy, an Arthurian fantasy, back in the Middle Ages.
By the way, I am looking at all these very amusing comments. I'm the walking personification of the word cancelled, apparently.
And there's dead a lot man cancelled.
And there's a lot of a lot of talk about
cancelled man walking.
How you should have been cancelled for Dr. Valverde.
Yes. Okay. So should we come to Dr. Valverde?
But before we do that, Tom, just on Senegal, my feeling about this. So I did enjoy that episode a lot. I enjoyed the conversation that we had at the end. And I think I probably came across that we were both really interested in the subject. Somebody contacted me and they said, oh, you're basically saying it's okay to exaggerate or falsify history. It's not that I'm saying it's okay to, but I'm saying human nature.
I think
human nature being as it is, when people tell stories about the past, they will inevitably romanticize, sentimentalize, exaggerate, slightly distort or hone a story. And there's a slight cottage industry of historians moaning and groaning about that. And I think there's no point in moaning and groaning as long as it is very clear that there is also a scholarly history that is kind of sacrosanct, as it were, sacral. And I think the issue with this, wasn't it, Tom, was that it was basically the attempt by academic historians to say, hold on, and then them getting, as it were, cancelled and then being forced to apologise. That was the thing that I think, but we would say, I would certainly say, is disturbing. Yeah. I don't think the Disneyfication of a site, I mean, that's frankly going to be inevitable. Because, I mean, what historical site isn't to some extent slightly Disneyfied with a gift shop, with a ticket office, with a cafe?
Yeah, but it's not just that. It's not just, so similar criticisms have been levelled at Auschwitz. But there's no question that what happened at, you know, what people think happened at Auschwitz did happen.
Yeah.
I mean, Auschwitz is clearly a fitting place of pilgrimage for that reason. It is sanctified by the sufferings that did happen there. The thing about the house of slaves and the door of no return is that symbolically they're incredibly powerful. You go there and you are walking the streets of a trading center that slaves would indeed have walked through, and that door of no return is incredibly powerful because you know the visual symbolism of it is so potent, but it's been overhyped. That's really the issue, and it's clearly been hyped to serve the tourist industry.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not unusual. That's not unheard of. But it's more. I don't think I either of us would say that is the end of the world. Oh, doom and gloom. I think to me, I just think if that's what the Senegalese want to do, let them crack on with it.
And if people want to go there, let them go to it.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the attempt to sort of silence somebody who says, hold on, this is a bit dodgy. Tink Joe is, I know what he's doing. They can have their myths, but they'll never but they'll never take our loot. I think I know who Tink Joe is. I think he's somebody that I used to know at university.
Oh, well.
Who's currently leading the Fantasy Football League of rest is history. Wangs, would you believe, Tom?
Oh, I didn't know they had
one. Did you know they have a fantasy football league?
No.
They do.
What, for the World Cup?
Yeah. No, generally, like Premier League players.
Oh, like brilliant.
Proper, yeah.
What, for the Premier League or for the World Cup?
The Premier League. I don't know if they have a World Cup edition. Do they have a World Cup edition, Tinker? Well, you can let me know. Right, let's move on. We've got loads to get through. You got a bit of grief because you said the longbow was a Welsh weapon.
Yes, I obviously got that wrong. I thought
is
it
that
was.
Not right? I the Ladybird book says it is.
That's what I thought. <That's> definitely when I read all my books on the Hundred Years' War, that's what they said. But
yeah, so
no, I didn't check that.
We
up.
Are going to do Agincourt as part of a massive epic that we've got planned, haven't we, Tom? Are we
on the Hundred Years' War.
On the Hundred Years' War. So Agincourt, the Black Prince, Cressy, all that stuff. Joan of Arc. We've got all that coming next year. Believe it or not, just before I came on here, I was looking at the secret spreadsheet that we have online, which has episodes penciled in for November 2023. So we're thinking that far ahead. Yeah, it's kind of terrifying, isn't it, Tom?
All in the planning.
Yeah.
These are anniversaries, aren't they? Can we say what the anniversary ones we're doing are?
Well, it's obvious. I mean, it's November 2023, it will be 60 years. It's a very well-known event, which is, of course, the yeah. launch of Doctor Who.
yeah.
And that's something else happening in America.
She loves you.
Yes. Yes. So we've got tons of fun episodes actually coming soon. Just on the Welsh episode, Simon Girdleston asks a question about Offa's Dyke and why it was built. Why was it built, Tom?
Well, we don't really know because we don't really have any sources explaining why it was built. I mean, I don't think it was built to keep the Welsh out. I think it was built as a kind of marker of royal power.
Right. Yeah.
There are all kinds of theories, but I think that seems the likeliest. Okay. It's the kind of thing that Anglo-Saxon kings were always building dikes all over the place. And Offa's Dyke was simply the most impressive. I mean, but kind of willy waving, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark Morris talks about that in his book on the Anglo-Saxons, as I recall. Have you read that book, Tom?
I haven't.
You haven't? I suppose you feel
no, I haven't. Tom. I haven't.
Is it one of those things where there's a popular historian publishes a book in your area and you think, I'm not going to read that?
No, I would absolutely read it. Because I've read his great book on the Norman Conquest on Edward I. I've read both of those.
Yeah.
It's just it came out when I hit my, well, actually pretty much when the podcast began, I think. And I had to start work on this book that I may have mentioned. So I literally haven't had time to read anything at all that is not related to the book or to a podcast. And I've just changed. And the book that I'm currently reading is on a Welsh theme, recommended by you, Aberystwyth Mon y Mamor.
How are you getting on with that?
But we haven't mentioned that yet, have we? Because that was in the episode that we did on Argentina.
Oh, God, yeah.
Okay, so we should explain to listeners. We have another Welsh-themed episode coming up, which is to do with the Welsh colony in Patagonia, which Welsh colonists went out in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And Dominic, tell the listeners about this book because it's really good. Are you enjoying it?
I'm really enjoying it.
Yes.
So there's a series of books by a novelist called Malcolm Price, who it turns out went to school with my old tutor. So there you go. In Wales. And they are...
Is he very old?
No, because my tutor was quite young when he taught me.
Oh, okay.
They are sort of noir thrillers, kind of hard-boiled thrillers, but they're set in a parallel universe in the town of Aberystwyth in Wales, where Wales kind of had... So the movement of Welsh colonists to Patagonia resulted in a kind of Welsh empire. And there's clearly been this great trauma of the Patagonian War, Wales's Vietnam. And there you go. There's the Fantasy Football League code for those of you who are interested. The Welsh Vietnam. And the books are full of sort of references to veterans on the beaches of Wales, kind of mourning their wounds and you know, badly traumatized and all this kind of thing. But there's also, it's a world in which the Druids still exist and wield tremendous power.
Well, not only exist, but they're kind of like Al Capone. I mean, they're running the town.
They are,
very. And the whole thing is very Raymond Chandler. So it's all...
It is very Raymond Chandler, exactly.
Philip Marlowe, and actually the plot of the one I'm reading is, I mean, you know, the very title.
Yeah, they're all ripped off from kind of Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett or whatever.
Anyway, I'm really enjoying it, so I thank you for that recommendation.
And
I'm just enjoying the fact we've done all these episodes, and so now we've got kind of 2 weeks where we're not recording an episode that I have time to read stuff that isn't. Although, having said that, I'm busy swatting up.
Oh, God almighty.
So the historical Jesus is moving into view.
Do I have to be present in that episode? Are you sure?
You do. You do.
I just say hello, everybody. Okay, off you go, Tom. And then goodbye. yes. So
that's discussion of sources coming. You're going to love it.
Okay, let's move on. So we did an episode about the last emperor of Brazil. Rich H says, I'm sure Dominic would be pleased to hear that two of Isabel's sons, so that's Pedro II's grandsons, Luis and Antonio, enlisted and fought in the British Imperial Forces in the First World War, surely enshrining the whole family as friends of the show. Well, we did say that Don Pedro, you'd found a friend in Don Pedro II.
I had. He loved dinosaurs.
Yeah.
He freed slaves. What's not to like?
He had a head like a banana, though, Tom. On the other hand, that's a little bit more complicated because Diogo Baptista says he was called Pedro Banana, but in Portuguese, when you refer to somebody as a banana, it means they're weak and easily manipulated. Is a banana and easily, I suppose it is quite easily, physically, it's easily manipulated. So Diogo, in answer to your question, you're saying basically because of his interest in the science of travel abroad, his sort of sensitivity, he was seen as a weak ruler. And I think that is absolutely right. I think there was a sense in the Brazilian military in particular in the late 19th century that they were itching for somebody who sort of personified the what they saw as the masculine martial virtues.
A Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro. He's not wrong. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that there was a sense that Dom Pedro, with kind of writing letters to Wagner and inspecting butterflies, and admirable as he may sound to us, was not sufficient for them. And actually, there's a comparison there with Louis Philippe in France, who the French kicked out in 1848. And actually, Louis Philippe had been quite
popular. He was compared
king.
To a pair, wasn't he?
He was compared to a pair, and he'd been a pretty good king, but he was too bourgeois for the French. They wanted somebody a bit more strutting and,
I mean,
Napoleonic.
Louis Philippe was called a pair because that was his whole physique, and he did look like a pair.
Yeah.
Whereas looking at Pedro II, he doesn't noticeably look like a banana. Do you think?
No.
I mean,
no.
Doesn't anything like a banana?
It doesn't look like a banana man.
So I think that Diogo Baptista, yes. I think he must be right. I think he's onto something there.
Jordan Lee says, is it true? Before that, Jordan Lee on the chat says, is it true that most of Brazil was unexplored by Europeans until the 1920s? I think there is a lot of truth in that. So there's a guy called John Hemming, who's written brilliant books about the exploration and, as it were, the conquest of large parts of South America. And I'm deep into Latin America at the moment, partly because I'm writing the next kid's book is about the Aztecs. So I've been and it was originally going to be about the entire Spanish conquest, but that was too big. And they were remarkable.
You're just doing the Aztecs, are you now?
Just doing the Aztecs now. Yeah, because it was too much. It was too much. Okay. The Incas was too much. But basically, the remarkable thing to me, the revelation to me, was how late huge swathes of Latin America were actually subdued by the sort of central authorities. So in other words, when people broke away from the Spanish and Portuguese empires at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, there were still kind of great swathes of kind of hinterland where basically colonial administrators and soldiers had never really gone. And it was actually liberal governments, as part of their project of liberal nation building, that actually destroyed a lot of indigenous life, not the Spanish, you know, oppressors, as it were.
That's such a Sandbrook paradox.
That's not my, I'm just telling you. No, I know. Other people's books.
But a paradox I'm sure that you enjoyed.
I always like a paradox, Tom. Now, the Ashanti Empire.
No, can we just mention Colonel Percy Fawcett, who we had
the Lost City
on the
of
show.
Zed. Yeah.
Lost City of Zed. And he was something to do with Ian Fleming, wasn't he?
Ian Fleming's brother?
Brother. Peter Fleming.
Yeah, yes. Peter Fleming.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes, Ian Fleming's brother had gone in search of Percy Fawcett, who was...
And never found him.
Never found him, yeah. The Lost
City of Zed
would be an absolutely superb topic for a podcast, Tom.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do that. I actually love the Latin American podcast because I think it's just such unfamiliar territory. Peter Wise, very good comment.
Yeah, yes, it's a very good book. Yeah.
I think
opportunities for music.
The sound of the rainforest, Tom. Remarkably similar to the sound of
Dominic. As I remember, you'd never heard of the 90s club classic Ecuador, which I should have included in our episode on Ecuador and didn't because
But that hasn't gone out. You can ask them to re-edit it and put it in.
Yeah, I might. I might do that. Guys, can we talk about this after this show? The Ashanti Empire, I really think that O.C. Monet's comment.
I want you to read that comment because I think that's... Read what O.C. Monet said.
Brilliant stuff. Holland wins again. Gold is still falling out of the sky included.
That's not what O.C. Monet wrote. O.C. Monet wrote, Holland comes storming back, suggesting that somebody else had built up a massive lead. That's the truth, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, whatever.
Well, to be fair, you did shoulder that burden of Qatar. So, you know.
I did.
You did Qatar and there was nothing to be there was no musical opportunities there. There were no amusing characters. There were no amphibian experiments.
Just a lot of trade deals.
Yeah.
It's never the stuff of vibrant podcasts.
You're never gonna live down poor old Dr. Valverde, are you?
Justice of Dr. Valverde, it seems like Tom has a frog in his throat. Yes, it is his revenge. Poland. I love the episode on Poland. I really want to go to Poland now.
Yeah, so what's this about? So Cohandler 93 asks a question about the dragon from Krakow, Smok, who lived under the hill. Was this an inspiration for Tolkien's Smaug, the dragon under the hill in The Hobbit? I checked David Day's book Tolkien, and it says Smaug was a Beowulf derivative, but surely this is too coincidental. Do you have any views on this, Tom? Is it the dragon?
I don't. Isn't I? Well, look up the etymology of Smaug.
What is the etymology? Me?
I don't know. I was asking if you could. Yeah, because I'm going to discourse on the universal nature of the dragon.
Okay, go for it.
I mean, basically, there's only so many plots that you have with a dragon. And essentially, it consists of a dragon sitting on a hill in a cave, whatever, or roaring around, and then somebody comes and kills it. And that's the basic plot. I thought the thing that was interesting about this was the kind of uselessness, really. I mean, the kind of underhand way that he poisons the poor dragon. Like he's a rat catcher or something.
I'm looking not just at the Bodleian, but I'm looking at the Tolkien Gateway online.
Okay, Benji Lee has come up.
Smaug is the past tense of the primitive Germanic verb smugen. squeeze through a hole. But it's been suggested that Tolkien thought of Old English smeag, a word used to describe a worm. Yeah, there you go. Benji Lee is on the same page as me. And on the Tolkien Gateway.
Maybe it is just a coincidence then.
Although maybe the Polish...
Smok and Smaug.
Maybe they have a similar route.
Yes, could be.
I mean, they could...
Yes, because the dragon would be... having a German name would brand it as sinister and dangerous. And
yeah, maybe.
For
maybe.
The Polish imaginings. I don't know.
Just a couple of more things about Poland. Pablo L. asked, was surprised we didn't mention Auschwitz, as it's obviously one of Poland's most visited places and clearly of massive importance. I suppose it's not a wanderer and you wanted to make it a light-hearted episode. The truth is, we were just... That was my choice, but it wasn't really a choice because I was just completely confined by the Rzeczpospolita newspaper list. So I just took the seven wonders from that the newspaper had voted for. And obviously the Poles were hardly going to vote for Auschwitz as one of the wonders of their country. We have got an episode coming up. We are recording it in 2 days' time. It is with the writer and columnist Jonathan Friedland, who wrote an excellent book about the man who escaped from Auschwitz. So he will be telling us about this guy who broke out of Auschwitz and tried to warn people in Hungary. And the great tragedy is that actually they didn't really act on the... I mean, they
saved about 20,000, didn't they, I think?
Or, yeah, but basically the argument is that if people had acted more quickly, people didn't listen. I think the fascinating thing actually about... We'll get into this when we record with Jonathan in 2 days' time, Tom, but the fascinating thing is that people were paralysed. And it really made me think about how paralysed I would be in a similar... You know, it's very difficult to just pack up all your stuff and go into hiding in a cellar. And obviously a lot of people just didn't and wouldn't. They just think it won't happen to me. My neighbors will, you know, I just can't believe it. And so, yeah, it's a terrible story, but a fascinating one. But also the guy escaping from Auschwitz is an incredibly exciting story.
I mean, I think we have felt the whole way through that the slave trade and the Holocaust are the two huge topics that we've felt slightly... I mean, we knew we had to do them at some point, But I think that this Jonathan Friedman's book is so good. It's a good way into that particular topic. Yeah. I think it's the conjunction of the topic with the jaunty theme tune that causes me some anxiety.
Right. Yes. So, hello and welcome to the rest of history. Today,
yeah, we are... Sunny Old Pants, yeah.
Yeah. There was a couple of points about canals, the boat that travels uphill. Lots of people contacted us and specifically me and said, as a Shropshire lad, shocking that you didn't know that there's one in Shropshire.
Did you know? Or had you just forgotten?
I've been to the... So there's one apparently, the Ironbridge Gorge Open Air Museum, which I've been to about 30 times.
He just blanked it.
The truth of the matter is, Tom, I'm not terribly... I may have feigned
industrial infrastructure.
Industrial infrastructure is not really my thing. So normally when I'd be trudging around thinking, when can we get to the gift shop? Which is actually what I think about a lot of museums. So probably I should just be keen on giving it stuff back or away because I could get to the gift shop more quickly. I don't know about the goats of Poznan. Kathy MG asks about the goats of Poznan. We'll just have to... Titmus, boring. Ironbridge is not boring. You've shamed yourself there. It's not boring. People should go to Ironbridge. It's a brilliant site. Bridge itself is amazing. The bridge is incredible. It's a beautiful site.
What was I going to say? I can't remember. I'm so ill. I can barely function.
Are you, Tom? I
am ill.
You got a heavy cold, flu, COVID?
Flu, I think.
Oh,
or also known as a cold.
I was about to say, would Sadie call it flu?
No, she wouldn't. She'd call it a cold, and she'd be right. It is just a cold, but not at my freshest. So the return of Bart Van Loo, or Van Loo.
Van Loo, yeah.
Van Loo. This was wow. Bart is wonderful, says Prince Hal. More episodes viewing history through art should be in the future. Thank you. Well, I'm interested I'm relieved to hear that, because I was slightly worried. It was an episode that depended a lot on Bart describing paintings, because it was about a painter.
Yeah.
And I thought, would it work? I mean, I don't know. Would it have worked if you didn't know the painting, or if you couldn't bring the painting up and have a look at it as Bart was describing it? And I guess it must have done, because I can't believe that everybody looked at the paintings.
I think you're more anxious about these things than I am.
I'm a very anxious person, Dominic.
I like episodes. I'd love to do more episodes as on the record about books, about writers and things. And I think, especially when they're good characters. Now, I think Jan van Eyck, actually, the one issue is that we know so little about him as a character.
But all the great stuff about him designing the enormous parties and
that's
mechanical elephants and all that kind of stuff.
That's all very good fun. And and the paintings are so incredible. But also Bart's, I mean, he couldn't work with... If it was some sort of slightly tedious art critic, that wouldn't work at all. But Bart is so enthusiastic. I mean, he's so...
I loved his description of we're there on the day... When it's opened, and we're like the Duke of Burgundy, and it's opening up. No, he's...
You know what, Tom? He's doing that in a foreign language as well.
I know.
I mean, he's doing it in a, it's
his third language.
Yeah. We hadn't sort of talked to him about what we're going to do. We just said, can you come on and talk about Jan van Eyck? It's like he's just a great, great natural communicator. And then they're not always hard to they're not always easy to come by, are they?
No.
So have we got... Fran Brooks appreciated my attempt at art criticism, Tom.
Good. Yes.
So I think I've mentioned this before, that Tom and I both separately never did it together. We were sometimes guests. You were on the Saturday Review sometimes, weren't you?
Yes.
On Radio 4? Yeah. So there was a program on BBC Radio 4.
That's when I got physically assaulted after being rude about Bob Dylan.
That's right. Yeah.
I must have told you about that. Yeah.
So we did mention this before, but you had to do this thing where you'd be given a given week. You're a guest on the show. There's going to be three other pundits, and you're given a play, a book, an art exhibition or something. What else would there be? TV program and a film.
And a book. And you mentioned that.
Yeah. And you've got to consume them all. You've got about 5 days to do the whole thing. So it's quite a big commitment. And then you go and do the show. And the one thing I used to dread was if it was like, here's a big exhibition and it is Jan van Eyck, I'd be like, great, there's loads to talk about. But sometimes they would say a new exhibition and it's called like gendering space in the age of climate change.
No, and it I wouldn't. Think, it, oh, it would always. Christ. It would be something. It would be. I mean, it would be the kind of title that I would come up for a podcast. It would be a Sceptredile ?
Yeah,
it would. Meditations on British rural communities, and it would be held in Bridge North Art Gallery or something.
No, that's all right. It would be the modern ones that were bloody in Shoreditch, Tom, that I struggled with.
Oh, I never got those.
Where you'd go in and it'd be art installation, it'd be video installations of a woman staring out of a window while the rain hammers down. And there'd be a caption next to it written by some sort of Dan Hicks figure that would say, what is space? What is gender? You know, something like this. And I'd go and I'd think, I have nothing to say about this.
So these presumably are available to listen. You talking about gendered space.
No, because obviously I wasn't going to turn up and say, especially when I was younger, I wouldn't have turned up and say, this is the most awful tosh and it's completely over my head. I would say, beautiful use of colour, really made me think.
That's why I want to listen to it.
Yeah. Right. We're back to the golf club, Tom. We need to steer away from this.
But yes, what other artists would be good window into a period of history? Picasso would be great.
Impressionism? You could do Impressionism because you could talk about 19th century France.
Would be amazing. Actually,
do you know what? Picasso completely leaves me cold, Tom.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. You don't have to like the art.
Maybe you're right.
Guernica and everything. It'd be fabulous. Yeah. I think we should do, I'd love to do one on Guernica.
I've been to Guernica. The place and the painting. Yeah.
So you've been to Guernica.
No one is better. I'll be the guest.
Yeah. You are. Okay.
Goya. Colonel O'Neill makes excellent suggestion. Goya.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Is a very good suggestion.
Frida Kahlo, all the Renaissance ones would be...
The Pre-Raphaelites, we could do that in Birmingham.
Oh, Pre-Raphaelites.
Benji Lee. Do you like the Pre-Raphaelites, Tom?
No.
You're not a teenage girl?
No, I'm not.
I'm not a teenage girl, and I do like the Pre-Raphaelites, so there you go.
Well, that reflects very well on your gender ambiguity, Dominic. Very 2022.
I have very androgynous.
Well done,
artistic pieces.
But the Renaissance, the big names, the big three. I mean, certainly the big two: Leonardo and Michelangelo. They'd be brilliant.
Shall I tell you something? I couldn't care less about Renaissance art.
So,
I like. Well,
doesn't matter. You'd find it interesting.
That really does leave me completely cold. I kind of look at that and just think,
you hate. Yeah, but Leonardo as a figure. It's amazing. All his tanks and his fossils and his...
What I will say is...
You know, his mad paint and stuff.
Incredibly useful kit in Assassin's Creed.
Does he? Well, I wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
So, but I may do when I go into my my lengthy break.
You're not going to play video games in your lengthy break.
I really want to try it ever since you told me about it.
I just can't see you doing it, Tom.
Well, I'm a bit anxious about having to kill people.
So I had to do that. Did I ever tell you that I had to do that on Radio 4? Review. One of the things we reviewed, it was so random. It was like Gendering Climate Change, the exhibition, a novel by Don DeLillo, The Beaux Stratagem at the National Theatre, and Call of Duty. And the three people who were reviewing Call of Duty were me, a professor of theatre criticism called Maria Delgado, and the historian, Amanda Vickery.
And we all had
to go to Tom Sutcliffe's, the presenter's house, where he'd set up his son's games console. And they didn't know how to use the controller. So they couldn't even walk the man around. You know, it was laughable. It was absolutely laughable.
So were you able to kill them all?
Well, no, I was trying to show them. They couldn't even, you know, you have a man with a gun.
Isn't the aim to kill everybody?
Yeah.
So why are you helping them?
No, because they were saying... Oh, it's a single-player campaign.
Oh, I see. Okay, whatever.
Anyway, listen. Benji Lee, Amanda Vickery was my tutor. We did invite Amanda Vickery on the podcast, and she didn't come on. So read into that what you will.
I think she's the only. I think she's the only person who said no.
Yeah,
I think. Which is great credit to her. I admire her for that.
Yeah. So, what's this? Oh my god, I can't believe they're putting that on the screen. So Tom Holland, yes, this is from our WhatsApp conversation. Is this going to be a new thing? This is not something that I was.
Yeah. So I love the way that the confidentiality of the WhatsApp group is being portrayed here.
Yeah.
I will have to watch very carefully what I type from now on.
What I very much enjoy about this is Tom it's being divulged that Tom writes in a WhatsApp message, personally effete and metropolitan as I am, I like in Bruges. And then the conversation ends with me shouting at him, go back to supporting Ghana. Because there was a big
I think I was actually supporting Uruguay.
Yes, I was supporting Uruguay. I love Uruguay.
Yeah, of course. They're the primal World Cup team.
They are, but I also admire their they have a thing called that Jonathan Wilson has written about called Gara, which means claw. And they have this
love it.
This sort of claw is meant to be their sort of demonic will to win, which unfortunately let them down this tournament. So
listen, enough of that. We've got some a Resident History restaurant, which Stephen Clark came up with various menu ideas, Kaiser soup, Bismarck herrings, a General Gordon sandwich, and so on. I think that's all great. Rouser suggested frog's legs de Valverde. So that's
very good.
Things going to run. And then to end this, we're coming to the end. Claire H., I have a question about friend of the show ranking. Is there a qualitative difference between friend of the show and very much a friend of the show? I think there is, isn't there? What is the ranking? Would it be, and she asks, top is Athelstan, second is Wang, third is very much a friend of the show, four is friend of the show, five is not a friend of the show, and six is Hitler. I like that ranking.
Where's Virginia Woolf and David Lloyd-George in that list?
Well,
the thing that is ambiguous about the friends of the show is they can be, you know, when we first started... You know,
they're often listeners, weren't they? Who were contributing.
So, like, let's say I'm just picking a name at random. You know, Tim Basby Burney was a friend of the show and a top vicar. But also, you know, Don Pedro II is a friend of. I mean, are they both equally friends of the show? That would seem. I'm not dissing either Don Pedro or the Reverend Tim Basby Burney, but
Dr. Valverde, I think, would now rank as a friend of the show, wouldn't he?
Very much a friend of the show, Tom. Do you know what? Tony, our producer, said to us today, he's very keen for us to do a similar series of global history podcasts next year for the Rugby World Cup. And I was looking at the list of countries. So there's a lot of Oceania, Tom, which you will be doing.
So that's Fiji, isn't it?
Fiji, Tonga. Love all that. Yeah. But I was horrified to see that one of the countries that's qualified is Uruguay. And I thought, no. So, A, I can use the panpipes, but B, I'm not sure that how much more Uruguayan history there is. Well, I should have to educate myself.
Wouldn't it be Argentina as well? They play rugby, don't they?
Yeah, they've qualified.
And Australia?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all
more.
There's
more to do on, yeah.
Yeah.
So, few quick questions. Alistair Colville, where does Meghan land in that ladder? I think she's probably not. Actually, do you know what? I'm writing an article about her tomorrow. There you go. That's something
we'll find out. I think she'd be not a friend of the show, wouldn't she?
She's not. Her podcasting style is not ours. I think it's fair to say, Tom.
No.
Benji Lee, will there be any Christmas specials? There are not going to be the 12 days. You were trying to do the 12 days again.
It was madness. I freely admit it.
Madness. But there are sort of Christmas-themed subjects.
Well, it's not. It's a Christmas present. It's the historical Jesus, which was a subject of a poll, wasn't it, months and months ago? Yeah. And you chose. Oh yes, history of booze. So we're doing the history of booze. We're recording that in a venerable wine merchant cellar.
Yeah.
And that will go out, I think, on Boxing Day or the day after Boxing Day or something like that. So it's a kind of New Year's Eve, Boxing Day celebration of alcohol. So that we've got that. And we're doing a roundup of the year, 2023. That was the year that was. 2022, sorry. Yeah. And then...
Yeah. Just a quick couple of things. Alex C., he was excited about rugby. He says world number ones, an Irish episode at last. Let me tell you now, Alex.
Oh, so much Irish stuff.
There are multiple Irish episodes being planned for next year. If it works out, it is not merely that there are Irish episodes recorded. The rest is history. We'll be visiting the Emerald Isle. So that is something that we are very excited about. Tom, I think the Brazil game is going to kick off at any moment. Ian Bould asks, what your favourite history books of the year are?
I will have to sit down and work that out in preparation for the 2022 a special episode because I can't remember. I can't remember. You know, it's all a blur. I would have to sit down and work out what I've actually read this year. Because I've read quite a lot of books that were probably published last year. That's the problem.
Stephen Merriman suggests that we go to Ireland and I can do Oliver Cromwell. I think the people of Ireland would be delighted to hear that take.
I think the people of Ireland will be looking forward to two Englishmen coming and talking about their history.
Yeah.
What could possibly go wrong?
Well, we will be doing that actually to some extent, but we'll be doing it with the sensitivity that listeners expect.
Yeah, we will.
Right. Tom, you really do need to go and have a cup of tea or some lemon sip or something.
Susan, I can't. I've got to go to my agent's Christmas party.
Oh, yeah, have to.
No, I have.
So you're missing the Brazil game.
Yeah.
Insane. Go to France and do Waterloo. Yeah, go to France and do Waterloo. We were talking, weren't we, that what a brilliant thing it would be for us to go to Belgium at some point and to do a sort of, because there's so many interesting historical sites in different
in
eras.
In Bruges, Dominic, in Bruges.
Well, that could be in Bruges. I would allow you to call that in Bruges if it was genuine episode about Bruges.
Thank you.
We could do in Waterloo. We could do in Ypres. We could do in Ghent. The historical Santa, Father Christmas, to some of us, Titmus.
We've done that, haven't we? We did, because one of our very first episodes was on Christmas.
It was.
We did Father Christmas.
And actually, that was one of those early episodes where we did it probably
too fast.
Too fast, yeah.
Yeah.
Because in those days, that was when Tony was exerting more control. He would write terrible introductions and he would say, kind of no longer than 35 minutes. Doreen is absolutely right. Don't go. Think what Carl Harper would tell you to do. He would say, move to the countryside. And Tinker, the match is on. It's so unlike you to still be on the live stream. And
Jensen Gendt is good, though.
It is good, but I don't understand what's happened to him. I knew him 30 years ago and there was none of these puns and all football. Now he's just punning on history live streams and it just is overturning my sense of what is right with the world.
But it shows that people can evolve and change.
That's
the essence of history, is it not, Dominic?
It is. Right. On that bombshell,
evolution and change, there would be no rest of history and that would be a great shame because we wouldn't be here.
We should let you go.
Yes.
Tom, God almighty.
I'm so ill.
So what have we got coming up? What's tomorrow?
What is tomorrow? It's Switzerland.
Yes. So Switzerland, the Welsh and Patagonia.
Involves the burning of heretics.
Tom, do you want to choose the brilliant title that you've chosen for Holland, for your Dutch podcast?
The Maid of Holland.
The Maid of Holland. Then we have an episode about the top Japanese people. We have an episode about French filmmaker mysteriously murdered.
When you say French filmmaker, I mean, he's not a maker of films. He's literally a maker of film.
Yeah, maker of film. He made film.
Who vanishes.
Yeah. We have the most famous Cameroonian general in history. We have the birthplace of civilization in Serbia. Don't call it the birthplace of writing, Tom.
I wasn't.
Well,
I want to come up with a very, very
Sambrookian title.
Sexy, a kind of Graham Hancock type title.
Oh, that's very good. So loads of fun things. We should let them go to the off to the football. Tom,
nice of you.
Are England going to beat France?
France won 3-1. And we won 3-0, so we
that's
did
your
better.
Test. That's your. That's your...
I mean, it's the only test I can provide, really.
Okay.
No, I think
I think we've actually got a chance. I think it's going to be very close that game. Could go to penalties.
No, I don't.
We know what happens when England games go to penalties, don't we? So
right on that depressing note.
All right. Bye bye, everybody. Bye bye, Tom.
Au revoir. Au revoir.
Bye.
À bientôt. Bye bye.